What is going on, Blenders? It's Sean, and I wanted to punch in before this bonus episode with Barry Sonnenfeld to explain a couple of things that happened. So you're going to hear a couple of audio stitches over the course of the interview, and it's really just because as we're all doing this work from home deal and we're trying to get these interviews brought into the podcast, it leads to some technical issues. And Barry Sonnenfeld is in Colorado and was having some Wi-Fi issues, so we kept dropping out and then joining back into the call. He was so gracious with his time, and every time he came back on, he just extended further the amount of conversation. You're going to see how long this conversation with Barry actually goes through, because there's so much to get to with the material, with his career. I also kind of want to just give you a warning at the top that because of the way that his book is structured, which is the reason why we have him on the show this week, we did get into his early career, his early film career, which happens to take place in the adult film industry. And Barry didn't hold back in sharing some of his stories. So it's a little graphic initially, a little more graphic than you might expect from a normal Real Blend episode. And if you want to skip to the 10-minute mark, that's when you're going to start getting into more stories about his work in the Men in Black franchise and his collaboration with the Coen brothers, how he survived a plane crash and almost died, and all these amazing stories that make his book so extremely colorful. So I just wanted to set both of those things up for you guys before you listen to this week's episode. And so without further ado, our interview on the Real Blend podcast with the director, Barry Sonnenfeld. So Barry, honestly, in about a day's time, I ripped through your book. It was one of the fastest reads that I've enjoyed in a really long time. Heavy as the material can be at some times, I found myself laughing out loud so much. And I think a lot of it's being from New York and understanding that personality and that humor. I connected with so much of it. This is an odd question, but I need to know, and I'm sorry to lead with this, but I have to know personally how you're processing the reality of a global pandemic going on right now.
You know what? I don't want to make fun of the global pandemic, but for over a year, since the very first time I gave my first draft to the editor at Hachette, everything has gone wrong in my life. And I think, although I don't believe in heaven, hell, God, the afterlife, I know that my mother, dead though she be, has done everything in her power to prevent this book from coming out. And when she couldn't prevent it, I mean, literally the day it was sent to the publisher, my first draft, I was rushed to the hospital and had emergency gallbladder surgery. So I had my gallbladder removed. Then weeks later, I had to have my right eyeball drained.
Ooh.
The retina scraped, my eyeball refilled with artificial vitreous humor. And then literally for a week, I had to lay 24/7 in a down facing position. I had to just walk to the bathroom like this. I had to drink my martinis with a straw because I couldn't look up. and then, in fact, I was going to call the sequel to the book, Barry's Book of Vitreous Humor, in fact. And then literally when all that finally worked out and I had to have a second surgery and I had yellow jaundice and I had internal bleeding, all from my mother desperately trying to get this book not to come out. It finally comes out. So she creates a coronavirus so that I can't go on my book tour. I was in New York for 9 days and then had to come back. I live in Telluride, Colorado, and that's where I've been. And all my book tours have been canceled. So I somehow blame my mother. And how could you not blame? How could you, if you were my mother, wouldn't you want her not to have this book released?
I mean, well, I think one of the lines I laughed at the loudest was when she said to you, next time you're going to say bad things about me, say bad things about your father, too. God, that was funny.
So I don't want to get too far into the interview without sort of starting at this topic, starting at the beginning a little bit. But I want to talk about your career in porn and the time you started in the world of porn, and specifically just the idea of the skills that you learned on the set of a porn. Were there any skills that you learned working in porn that you would still use today? If you were to walk onto a set, you'd go, well, I remember that, and you would still use it?
I think that the porn people learned from me, actually, more than I learned from them.
How so?
In fact, the one thing I should have learned was not to stay very close to a double insertion with a wide-angle lens, because, as you guys know, I ended up being covered with a warm, loamy, effervescent fountain of human excrement.
Yeah. And Barry, that's part of what you got drained from your eye, right? That years later, you had to get that drained out. Yeah.
And part of the reason I got covered in a warm, effervescent, loamy fountain of human excrement was because I've always been a wide angle guy. If you look at all the movies I both shot and directed, I would literally say more than half of the images I've ever worked on were with a 21 millimeter or wider. 21, 17, 14 millimeter. So in 16 millimeter, the equivalent of a 21 is a 10 millimeter. I was a big fan of the F1.6 Sweetar 10 millimeter lens because what it does is if you're really close, let's say to a penis with a 10 millimeter lens, you know, the equivalent of a 21, it everything seems elongated and large and masculine and funny. You know, lenses can be funny. People don't realize this, but lenses have senses of humor. And I'm going to get back to you, Jake, but I will say that I shot Throw Mama from the Train for Danny DeVito, and Billy Crystal was the co-star, and everything was a 21 millimeter or the 17 and a half millimeter primo. And the next movie Billy did was called City Slickers. And I remember Billy calling me up and saying, hey, Barry, the DP is using long lenses. He's using telephoto lenses. Is the movie going to be funny? And I said, nope.
Oh, no kidding. Wow. Oh, my God.
It ended up being funny enough. And I will say that Westerns kind of needs oftentimes longer lenses than 21 millimeters. But 21 millimeter is a very funny lens. So what I would say is I didn't learn anything from shooting pornos. What they learned from me is block shooting. And what block shooting means, like if you're doing a TV series, let's say you only have 3 days with Alec Baldwin. What you do is you block shoot him in any scene he's in on any set. You shoot out Alec because you've made a special deal and you only have him for 3 days. Or if you have a certain location, you block shoot that location because you've only rented that church for a couple of days. Well, in the case of the nine feature-length pornos I shot in 9 days, what I did was I convinced the director and producer that once we had a set lit, and they were all bad sets, you know, who builds a dentist's office for pornos? You know, I mean, the guy was an idiot.
What was the name of the first porn you made?
You know what? I have no idea what their names were. They were 16 millimeters. So we shot these nine features in 9 days. But once you lit the dentist's office, you would shoot every scene that took place into dentist's office. And truly, the men had no sense of eroticism and found the worst way to shoot every scene that was totally not erotic. And
honestly, though, I can't wait to see a day. Barry, you should end your film career by shooting a porn in 65 millimeter IMAX then and having it display on at a science theater like Nolan does with like Tenet and Dunkirk.
Well, you know, here are the problems with that. First of all, because there are problems with it. First of all, I am not an IMAX fan because the format is wrong. It's neither 1.85 nor 2.35.
1.43.
So they either have to crop the top and bottom so you're not at an IMAX theater at that point. In addition, and maybe they changed this, but when we released One of the Men in Blacks in IMAX, They had no discrete subwoofer channel. So all the bass was coming out from the dialogue channel, which is why when you see Batman, the Chris Nolan Batman on IMAX, you can't understand a fucking word the man is saying,
right?
Because it's along with the visual, the sound effects channel. Mm-hmm. In addition, the last thing you want to do at pornos is have any kind of decent resolution. There's so many things totally wrong with seeing porno with any sort of decent resolution. So don't go there.
No, that's really funny. All right, so I'm going to take this back because Blood Simple is one of my favorite films ever made. And there's a shot in Blood Simple that to this day still blows my mind. I remember I was lucky enough to interview Joel and Ethan for Hail Caesar. And we talked very heavily about you and obviously you being on Miller's Crossing, these amazing movies you were involved in. But I wanted to talk to you about what you learned as a DP on the Coen Brothers set specifically that influenced the filmmaker you became. And the shot that I want to talk to you about specifically is the bar shot in Blood Simple. As your camera is going, you go over the person's head and back down. Can you talk about where that shot came from, what you and the Coens were discussing? Was it your idea? Was it their idea? Was it scripted that way? For our audience, though, real quick, can you explain what the shot is? Because it really is an amazing shot.
Before I explain it, I'm going to say to you, you're welcome, because the Coen brothers took the shot out of the movie. Oh. I was visiting their editing room one day. They were cutting at 1600 Broadway, which was a film building. And I visited the set, and that shot was out of the movie. And what the shot is we're in a bar, and the camera's underhung. And so it's very close to the surface of the bar, and it's tracking along the bar as the bartender, Maurice, and this woman. And by the way, that woman was Fran McDormand's stand-in, and we gave her that little part. Wow. So they're having a discussion, and we're tracking towards them, but there's a drunk laying across the bar, so the camera, when it gets to the drunk, booms up over the drunk, comes back down again, and then finds Maurice and this woman in a two shot. And I said to Joel, "Hey, why did you guys take out that shot?" And Joel said, "I don't know. Ethan and I felt it was kind of self-conscious." And I said, "The entire movie is self-conscious. You're going to pick on that shot?" So they put it back in. So you have me to thank for the shot to be in there. So here's the way Joel and Ethan and I work. For months, I laid on the floor and they paced, and we designed all the shots for Blood Simple together, and we'd come up with different ideas. And so all the movies I did with Joel and Ethan are all pre-planned. They're all first they're shot listed. Then we actually find the real locations and discover, oh, that shot won't work because the door is over there instead of over there. So we redo the shots and then we storyboard them. But I think we had a very similar aesthetic. I think what I taught them was the joy of wide angle lenses, which we've already discussed. And if you want to get technical, I'll explain to you what's so great about a wide angle lens. But the other thing is, because I'm an only child of Jewish persuasion, I thought it was very important that people pay attention to me. And I never thought I could be an actor. But what I realized is that a camera can be more than a recording device.
It's a leading character. The camera
can be
a character
yes. in the movie.
Just like that shot in Blood Simple.
And you look at all the stuff we did in Raising Arizona, going over the fountain in the car, up the ladder into Florence, Arizona's mouth. So for me, the camera is more than a recording device. It's a storytelling device. It can be comedy. It could be sad. So I think what Joel and Ethan and I learned together, because the first day on the set of Blood Simple was the first day that Joel, Ethan, or I had ever been on a movie set. None of us ever worked our way up. And if I have any advice to give people that are young and want to get into the film business, what I would say is decide what you want to be and declare that that's who you are. And that, and don't do anything else but that. I never was a camera assistant or a camera operator. Joel never had directed except for student films before. Ethan had never produced. And so what I did is when I got out of graduate film school, I bought a used 16 millimeter camera. This is way before video. There was no video. Now you would buy like a Nikon D something or a Sony A7IV or whatever. But then it was only 16 millimeter and 35 millimeter cameras. So I bought a used 16 millimeter camera so I could call myself a cameraman without being a dilettante. And what's weird is there were two guys at film school. We both lived in the same building on East 7th Street. One was me. One was Bill Pope.
Oh, wow.
And Pope.
Bill Pope is Sam Raimi's guy, man. He's amazing. Yeah, Pope
shot the Spider. And he actually shot Men in Black 3 for me. He shot Clueless. He shot the Matrix movies. So Pope and I were known as the two camera guys at film school. Even though at film school, everyone had to do everything. You had to write, direct, edit your own movies. You couldn't just be a script writer or something like that, which was really, I think, one of the good things about NYU is it taught you how movies got made.
Barry, this is a super quick follow-up because Sean is next, but only I want to ask you this because I was wondering when the baton kind of passed from you to Deakins, and then Deakins obviously took over with Hudsucker going forward, did you and Deakins ever meet and talk about like styles? Like did you guys ever have, I would love to know the history of that because you went on to do Adam's Family, but that's an interesting change.
Deakins and I, occasionally I'll visit the set of a Coen Brothers movie. I was visited the set one day on like Hail Caesar, and Roger won't even acknowledge me. I'll go, hi Roger. And he'll go, hello. Here's the thing. Roger's very good. But we had totally different styles in that I lit individual shots. Roger's whole thing is lighting sets. And once a set is lit, he shoots within that set, but he doesn't really change the lighting much for individual shots. And I remember seeing A Serious Man, which is one of the, I think, one of the best Coen Brothers movies, especially if you're awesome. Jewish. And I said to Joel and Ethan, and this gets back to Roger, I said, I got to say, it's my favorite movie that you guys have made since I was no longer your DP. And they said, why? And I said, no panning. I never let the Coens pan. Panning is the laziest thing you can do in designing and setting up shots. In fact, Joel, Ethan, and I were at the Ziegfeld for the premiere of Gangs of New York, the Scorsese movie. Wow. And Ethan said to me, why is that movie so bad? And I said, too much panning.
Can you explain that, though? Like, what do you mean? Why is panning bad? I read that in your book, and I couldn't understand it because it's probably something that we see on a regular basis, and I just didn't absorb it.
Panning is incredibly lazy. It's a lazy way to frame because, first of all, I like my frames to be square to the environment, right? So as soon as you pan, you're off square, right? Oh, yeah. If you track, you stay on square. If you push in, you're still in square. As soon as you pan, let the guy leave camera and pick him up in the right angle. Panning is so lazy. It's just recording. It's not designing. And the funny thing, and since you read the book, when I hired Owen Roizman to be my DP on Adam's Family, I say, I only have three requests. And he says, what are they? I said, First of all, I think that Angelica Houston should have her own motivated light. Even if she's standing right next to a window, Morticia should be lit like a Harrell photograph, you know, with a Charlie Barton. Yeah. So she should look beautiful and she should carry, in effect, her own motivated light. He said, I love it. I said, second of all, if you don't mind, I'd like to design the shots and pick the lenses because it's just the way I see and I cut a certain way. I don't shoot masters. I'll explain why and why all film schools should do what I'm about to tell you to do. And he said, I love that you can design all the shots, less work for me. And then he said, what's the third thing? And I said, I really want you to use 5247, which is a slower film stock, but very beautiful. It's got really rich blacks. It's not grainy. And Owen said to me the exact question I would have asked him. He said, will I ever have to pan? And I said, you will never have to pan. And he said, well, then I can shoot the slow stock. And I'll tell you why. The more, the slower the stock, the more light you need, obviously. And if you're panning, then all your lights that are just out of frame come into frame if you start to pan, right, which means the lights have to be further away. You need bigger lights, or the lights have to be higher up. And the higher up a light is, the less flattering it is on a face. So Owen ended up being the DP, but I will tell you that Roger, because he lit whole sets and not individual shots, let the Coen brothers start to pan. And I think that their movies just went downhill until A Serious Man, because that's the first one where they didn't pan. There is one panning shot, which is when Michael Stuhlbarg is up on his roof fixing the antenna so he could find F Troop for his kid. Yeah. And there's a panning shot of the neighborhood, and you see that Jewish woman who's sunbathing nude in the next yard. So that's, I think, the only pan in that shot. So Roger and I had very different styles. He's very, very good. I actually prefer the work they do with Bruno.
Interesting.
Talking about Blood Simple, obviously you met Joel Coen at a party. You guys start talking, and that's kind of where that whole relationship started out. So by no means, obviously, I mean, you went to school. By no means do I want to take away from the hard work and the talent and the determination. But how much of success in this business can be attributed to luck, in the sense that, like, you met a guy at a party and then that's where careers flourished from that moment?
Luck is everything. You're lucky that you didn't get hit by a bus today.
Very true.
You know, I used to look back over my career and think about the movies I didn't do and the movies I did do, and why did I do that one and why didn't I do this one? But truthfully, and Griffin the Arcanian will tell you this from Men in Black 3, every single second of every single day, there are trillions of decisions that are being made right now that's going to affect you tomorrow. So all my point is, yes, it was totally lucky that I met Joel Coen at a party and he was looking to shoot a trailer as if Blood Simple was a finished movie and needed someone to help him shoot the movie. And I said, I had a camera, and he said, I'm hired. And, you know, that led to us raising the $750,000 to make Blood Simple. That led to somehow getting accepted at the New York Film Festival. And listen, here's another lucky moment. That movie was reviewed in the New York Times by Janet Maslin, mm-hmm, and not Vincent Canby. Canby hated the movie. several of the next movies he reviewed after Janet Maslin gave this glowing review to Blood Simple, Canby literally would write, "Unlike Blood Simple, this is a good movie." He just hated Blood Simple. If Canby had reviewed Blood Simple, I don't know that I'd be talking to you guys today.
Wow.
So life is what it is. And you can't look back and you can't look forward. And you just have to accept that wherever you are is probably where you're supposed to be, I guess. I don't know.
Barry, I want to bring it back around to the book just for a second, because in reading through it from start to finish, you just come across as somebody who, because of your storied career, have a million stories that you can tell. You could tell a million stories about each film individually, I would imagine. So how do you, throughout the course of the process, choose which ones are going to be included and then put that structure together so that they'll flow into one comprehensive narrative?
You know, it's really interesting. You know, the New York Times, which gave it a great review, was angry that I didn't write about the Men in Black movies or Wild Wild West, which he obviously didn't like and wanted me to sort of have excuses for it or something. My book was twice as long. Here's my theory about everything. Shorter is better. There's only one movie I've ever directed that's longer than 90 minutes, and that's Get Shorty, because the script was 20 pages longer than a normal script. My book was literally twice as long, and I just took out 11 chapters.
Wow.
Because,
oh my gosh,
I just didn't want to bore people. And, you know, if the book does well and they want another one, I got another one already half written. I didn't want this book to be, you know, all about the movies I worked on, you know, nor did I only want it to be about my youth. You know, the first half is sort of what I wanted it to be about was about my neuroses and where it comes from and why it exists. And these were sort of interesting to me. You know, I could have written a book about, you know, a series of unfortunate events or the Men in Black movies, but you know, it will come. And I would literally sit at my computer and write 30, 40 pages a day. It was really easy for me. I have a good memory. I believe that the more specific a joke is, the funnier it is. So, you know, my book is full of specificity. But it just sort of, to be honest with you, I thought I was going to write a book in the style of David Sedaris. I thought I was just going to write a series of interesting stories that have happened in my life. I had no idea it would end up being kind of chronological. Mm-hmm. That sort of happened through the process. I'm jealous of Sedaris because I've written this chronological thing. In some ways, it was harder because I took out some really, really funny stories. I mean, for 3 years, I was an elevator operator at 40 Wall Street and would get car sick and have to stop the elevator on a mechanical floor and go off and vomit while an entire elevator full of lawyers were waiting for me to get done throwing up and getting back in the elevator. Because it's, you know, the kind where you turn the thing and there's a gate and all that. So there's so many stories that I just had to take out because I didn't want to bore people. But look, if I write a sequel, believe me, you'll read all about Wild Wild West, the Three Men in Blacks, Big Trouble, lots of more stories about, you know, my life and, you know, how we accidentally bought a house in Telluride and all that stuff. But
next to the very competitive Kelly Ripa.
Well, this homeowners association has four houses: Larry Kasdan, Jerry Seinfeld, Kelly Ripa, and me.
Wow.
So there's fun times to be had by all.
Wow. You know, Barry, I know you speak in the book about Penny Marshall, and obviously I know that you were the cinematographer on Big, and I'm just genuinely curious from a perspective of what it was like to shoot the piano scene on the day. What you remember about filming that? Was the sound being captured in the movie, the actual sound that was being made on the piano in the store? What do you remember about filming that with Tom Hanks?
It was a really, really hard day to film that scene for a variety of reasons. First of all, you know, again, we're talking about decades ago where there was very different lighting equipment. If we were shooting that today, under each key, there would have been LED lights.
Oh, wow.
LED lights are much cooler and much brighter. They're much more efficient. So under our keys were tiny little, you know, bulbs, you know, incandescent bulbs. So you couldn't have too many bulbs or you'd start to melt the keyboard.
Oh, wow.
So the challenge for that, it's funny you should talk about that because it looks pretty effortless except for Tom and Loja having to dance around a lot. But the problem was if the environment was too bright, the keys would not have glowed because the keys were not very bright. So I was constantly trying to put big blacks, you know, big pieces of duvetine in the windows to darken the room so that the lights would shine. Today it would have been much easier. We would have either used LEDs and we probably would have enhanced it because back then also, you know, there was no color suites there like there are now. You couldn't take individual parts of a frame and make it brighter or darker. So it was actually a really hard scene. The sound is totally post-production because what you were really hearing was Tom and Loja stomping on the keys. And so you could hear, I mean, it did make sounds, but it was aesthetically not pleasing.
How did Tom know what key to go to without sound?
Oh, no, there was sound, but it was, they could hear the sound, but it was totally not aesthetically pleasing. They would hear it, but what you were mainly hearing is clomp, clomp, clomp. And under clomp, 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 you heard da, 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 da. But they practiced and they did a great job. And, you know, Robert Loggia was not a spring chicken then, and he really worked hard and they rehearsed a lot. And I mean, everyone remembers that scene so well, but it was a nightmare to shoot. We were actually at FAO Schwartz. We only had 2 days there and had many other scenes. You know, Tom plays with guns and, you know, Nerf guns and stuff. So it was really difficult and not nearly as easy as it looked. Oh.
Speaking of Tom, you obviously got to get you really got to get to know him at a period of time in which he was more known for comedy. See, I mean, obviously, I know he got a first Oscar nomination for Big, but like he wasn't that far off of Bosom Buddies and you got to spend some time with him with the Burbs. But I'm curious, obviously, in the 90s, when I really started growing up with Tom Hanks is when he started being known as this more serious, dramatic actor. Were you surprised at the direction his career would take, sort of that shift whenever he got into the 90s?
You know, I wasn't. Tom was an incredibly great actor and incredibly lovely, you know, and incredibly patient with Penny, who was, you know, she was tough because she not only wouldn't make decisions, but really didn't give direction. I remember one night we were shooting in Tom's loft and Tom's been on a bed, on a date with Elizabeth Perkins, and he's in the lower bunk and he's on the top or vice versa. And we were doing 15 takes of Just Like a Master, which is just, you don't want to burn actors out on master takes because you're going to use it at the beginning of the scene and at the end of the scene. And Penny was lying on a Gumby chair being massaged while we were doing these takes. Literally, if you mic'd Penny, you would hear, luckily she was far enough away from the set. And, you know, at some point she would say cut, and then would go, okay, let's do it again. And I go, well, Penn, is there a reason why you want to go again? You know, we have all this other coverage to get to. No, let's go again. And she wouldn't even talk to Tom. So I would go to Tom and say, hey, Tom, Penny wants to do it again. And Tom would say, which is the right thing to ask, Tom would say, does she want me to do anything differently? Is there a reason we're going again? What does she want me to do different? Hold on, Tom. Hey, Penn, Tom wants to know if you want him to do anything different. Ooh. And Penny would say, no, just tell him do it again. So Tom was this great guy. In fact, here's the story. When I was finishing Adam's Family, the head of Paramount then, the president of Paramount, not the CEO, was a guy named Gary Lucchese. Gary had a script called, had a novel called Forrest Gump. And he said, look, I've got 8 scripts. They all suck. Can you read this book and tell me if you want to do it? So I read Gump, and the lead of Gump was actually a big fat guy who was really strong. It was like Confederacy of Dunces in many ways. And I said to Gary, well, here's what I would do. I would make Gump a runner instead of a fat, big guy, and I'll send it to Hanks if you're okay with it. And Gary said, sure, send it to Hanks. So I sent Hanks a novel. I said, you should be a runner, not a fat guy. I said, you probably don't want to do it because it's too much like big and that he's another version of a man child, you know? Hanks signs on. We get Eric Roth to write this screenplay. And then Paramount decides they want to do Adam's Family Values. So I said, I'll only do Adam's Family Values if you wait for me to do Gump, and I'll do both. Paramount says yes. Penny Feinerman, the not Penny Feinerman. What's her name? Feinerman, who was a producer and who was married at the time to Mark Canton, who was running Warner Brothers, says, I don't want to wait. And by the way, she's right. Hanks could die. There could be 3 other movies just like this one. There's so many things that could go wrong. She didn't want to wait. I had to choose between Forrest Gump or Adam's Family Values. And Adam's Family was, you know, my firstborn. You know, it was the first thing I ever directed. So it was an easy choice of me to do Adam's Family Values. What I should have done is made sure my agent, who's no longer my agent, but at the time was, to have gotten me a producing credit since I got Hanks and it was my idea to make him a runner. But it didn't happen. But anyway, I always knew that Hanks was going to be an actor that expanded beyond comedies. And he's just a really good actor. And and truthfully, what you really want in a comedy is a really good actor and not a comedian. My philosophy about comedies, and this is also in my book, is you never want anyone working on a comedy to know they're working on a comedy. You don't want the DP to know because it will be too bright. You don't want the lab to know, it'll be even brighter. You don't want the composer to know because there'll be slide whistles and triangles. You want the scene to be funny, but you want the actors to play it for reality. If the reality is absurd or stupid, it will be funny. But you never, ever want to say to an actor, can you do one funnier? You say to the actor, do one faster, and that will make it funnier. So I always knew Hanks was a real actor. And a real actor,
That's a big part of the reason why I think The Birdcage is one of the funniest films I've seen, because everyone in that film plays it seriously.
I love The Birdcage. In fact, Bo Welch, who was a production designer on many of the movies I've directed, was also the production designer on that, too. And I love The Birdcage. Everyone's just playing the reality of their character.
Yep. Yes, very much
and
so.
And that's what makes, and Robin is amazing in it. And he's sort of the least funny guy in that show.
Right.
And only Mike Nichols could sit on Robin that much to make him not vamp. And and it, he's great in it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you mentioning a potential reality where you almost directed Forrest Gump, where we see your version, not Zemeckis's. You also pepper in these little one-off statements throughout the book that got us thinking, or got me thinking about alternate versions of, you know, Dustin Hoffman potentially being in Get Shorty, Warren Beatty almost potentially being in Get Shorty. You mentioned that for a while, De Niro was considered for Big, which I didn't even know. So I'm just curious, like, how many of those have you heard over the years? You know, with all the different projects that you've circled or heard friends be involved in, potential classic movies that, if not for this thing that you talk about, the quantum mechanic of just, you know, these various changes, that do you have thousands of these that you know of?
Yeah, well, let's talk about Men in Black. You know, when I, Sweetie and I get, I call my wife Sweetie, we get scripts together. Mm-hmm. She gives me a 60-page head start because I'm a really slow reader. We read Men in Black and she turned to me and said, Will Smith. I turned to her and said, Tommy Lee Jones. I called the studio and the producers and said, it needs some work, but I love the concept, which is that we don't have a fucking clue what's really going on. Mm. And I love it and I want to do it. And they said, great, we want Clint Eastwood and Chris O'Donnell. And I said, well, I think it should be Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith. And they were okay with the Tommy of it. So we sent it to Tommy and I had a meeting with him and Tommy eventually came on board, but they would not give up Chris O'Donnell. Spielberg wanted Chris O'Donnell. And he said, look, you're going to be in LA next week. Chris is in LA. I want you to take him to dinner at the restaurant at the Four Seasons Hotel on Doheny and convince Chris to do this movie. Mm-hmm. So I take Chris to dinner and he says, you know, I have to tell you, A, I don't think the script is that good. B, I have this other opportunity to do something with Stallone. So why should I do Men in Black? And I said, well, first of all, if you have a chance to work with Stallone, you should do that. I worked with Stallone for a week before he fired me off of Tango and Cash.
I love Tango and Cash.
Well, I got stories. I got stories. Well, you read there's one whole story about, but I got a million more. this whole chapter about Tango and Cash. But in any case, I said, you know, Stallone's really smart and you should work with him. And I said, second of all, in terms of you worrying about the script for Men in Black, you should be worried. I don't think it's very good, and I'm not a good director, and I don't know how to fix a problem. So the next day, he passed on Men in Black, and a few weeks later, Spielberg spent his summers in East Hampton, and I knew that Will was at a wedding in Philly, and I arranged for a helicopter to take Will from the wedding to East Hampton. I made sure some of Spielberg's kids were there to tell Spielberg that Will was really good. Because remember when Will did Men in Black, the only feature he had done was 6 Degrees of Separation.
Right.
And
Independence Day. He had Independence Day coming out or not yet?
No. When he was hired, he hadn't even started Independence Day. And then while we were working on the script and all that, he started Independence Day. And in fact, the first 2 weeks of Men in Black, Will was still finishing Independence Day, but it hadn't come out yet. So it was only Fresh Prince and 6 Degrees of Separation. Oh, and Sweetie was a big Fresh Prince fan and thought Will would be really funny in that role, but it was never written for like a white guy or a black guy or anything like that. And right. Here's the other theory about comedies. not only do you never want anyone to like act funny, but you always need a straight man and a funny guy in your movie. You don't ever want two guys being funny in your movie. And what's great about Men in Black is that Tommy Lee Jones is George Burns and Will Smith is Gracie Allen. I can't imagine. I'm trying to remember of all the Big Trouble, which was a really good movie that no one saw because it was supposed to come out a week before.
I still do that that airport thing. Every time I go to the airport, I always go, are we arriving or are we departing? I still cannot figure it out. I always think of that.
I love that scene so much. And my wife and I to this day go, well, we're arriving at the airport, but we're departing on the plane. Right. Yeah, no, we still do it every time. Great cast. Warburton is great. Dennis Farina is fantastic. But that's an example where Disney insisted on the lead being, who is the lead? You know,
Tim Allen.
Disney insisted on Tim Allen. I really wanted Alec Baldwin.
Oh, okay.
Tim was fine. I thought Tim was trying to be a little too funny. I wish he was a little less funny, but he's good. But I think Alec would have been maybe better, but maybe who knows? But so there's almost no show we can talk about where the lead wasn't supposed to be someone else. And as you mentioned, when I started Big, it was De Niro. I mean, right. He was supposed to do it. And then Barry Diller, who was running Fox at the time, insisted on Hanks. Hanks had another movie. I left Big, shot Throw Mama from the Train with Danny, and then came back and did Big after finishing Throw Mama. And I loved the experience of working on Throw Mama. Danny and I loved every second of working together on that show.
Right before we were talking to you, I was messaging. This sounds like I'm name dropping, but there's a longer story behind it. But I was messaging with Josh Brolin, and I was telling him that I was speaking to you for the first time, and I'd never talked to you in a longer format before, and I was really excited to talk to you. And he was like, "Tell him I said hey." And he was, you know, obviously he loved working with you in Men in Black. So I was wondering if you had any stories about working with Brolin, what you saw in Brolin that kind of felt that he could be the younger Tommy Lee Jones. What was it about Brolin that kind of gave you that vibe? And what did you like working with him?
Well, first of all, Brolin and Tommy have the biggest heads, physical heads of any movie stars. And big heads make big movie stars. It's just like a rule. So first of all, I thought Brolin looked and could sound like Tommy. And I won the Directors Guild Award for directing the pilot of Pushing Daisies. Lovely. And it was the same night the Coens were there winning for No Country. So I'm up there making my speech and I'm looking down and there's Joel and Ethan kind of scowling at me because I remember I was spent a lot of time talking about my scrotum, which is unusual for the Directors Guild. But anyway, it happens. And there was Brolin, and I looked at Brolin, and I thought, Jesus, that guy looks like Tommy Lee Jones. The show's over. There's an after party. I'm hanging out with Joel and Ethan and Brolin. And I said to Brolin, hey, I think you'd be perfect as young Tommy Lee Jones. And he said, great. Sounds great. Send me a script. Now, here's an interesting story about agents. One of the most powerful agents there are is a guy named Ari Emanuel. He's the head of William Morris Endeavor, WME. And he's really good friends with Mark Wahlberg. And he really wanted, and I'm at WME also, and he really wanted Mark Wahlberg to play young Tommy Lee Jones. And I think Mark would have done a great job. But I think Brolin was born to play Tommy. And by the way, Brolin, the entire time we worked together, had a tape recorder and had all of Tommy's dialogue from the first Men in Black. And whenever he was on the set, he was listening to Tommy's lilt. And Tommy has the most musical voice. It's a beautiful voice. It really flows and ebbs. It's very sing-songy. And Brolin did a fantastic job. He made me cry so many times watching him. But the head of WME wants Mark Wahlberg. And this is, I don't understand why this works, but I would be sitting minding my own business somewhere and my cell phone would ring and Ari Emanuel's assistant would say, please hold for Ari. This happened twice. I go, okay. hi, Ari, what's up? You called me. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. Ari, I didn't call you. Yes, you did. I'm returning your call. Well, if you're returning my call, there's nothing to talk to you about. I didn't call you. You called me. Well, okay. Well, in any case, it was a mistake. Goodbye. Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Since I have you on the phone, what about Mark Wahlberg? Well, you know, he'd be great, but I've offered it to Josh. Well, you should meet Mark. Okay, fine. Goodbye. 2 weeks later, phone rings. Can you hold for Ari? Yes, I can hold for Ari. Hi, Ari, what's up? You called me. I don't know what the theory is, but I guess it's to show that he doesn't really care, that he wouldn't, so that he wouldn't make the fucking phone call.
Right.
Literally, I ended up having to meet Mark Wahlberg, and Mark was lovely. He was great. He would have been great in the role. But I wanted Brolin, so I got Brolin, and thank God the studio backed me up. But they were really nervous about, you know, making Ari upset that I didn't go with his guy. But Brolin was fantastic, and Brolin was brilliant at young Tommy. And I remember the one thing Tommy said to me about Brolin's performance is, where do you get that accent? I don't have any Texas accent. And I said, well, actually, Tommy, you do. He said, I don't think so. And I said, oh, okay. But Brolin was perfection. I loved working with him. And he had a hard time on that show because a lot of times he had to act off camera to me, and I'm a terrible actor. You know, Will would be back in L.A., and Brolin would still be in New York where we shot it, and I was doing off-camera lines. It was a tough job for him, and he was fantastic.
I love Hader in it as Andy Warhol.
Yeah, Bill Hader was fantastic, and I loved his line, which is, "I'm so out of ideas. I'm painting soup cans and bananas for Christ's sake," you know, because he's secretly a Men in Black agent, you know, pretending to be this artist. Hader was fantastic in it. I loved him. And, you know, I ran into him actually at the last DGA Awards. I was nominated for a series of unfortunate events, but lose every year to Sesame Street. But in any case, I said to Hader, hey, did you name your show Barry? Because Barry is like the worst, most lousiest, depressingest name for anyone to be named. And Hader went, yeah. And I said, believe me, I know. I'm not happy with Barry either. But I didn't say, did you name him after me? But I did know he named him after like the worst name any male could have is Barry. So thank you very much, Hader.
But Barry, you told me something earlier in this interview, which is very true, which is that I'm very lucky. Like, I could have been hit by a bus today, and I'm lucky that I wasn't. You almost died in a fucking plane crash. Like so much so that the pilot was fairly convinced that you were all going to die. I'm sort of curious, like, that's the sort of thing that changes a person. Like, you're like, I would imagine like your entire life perspective changes on the other side of almost dying in a plane crash. Like, did that affect you all? Did it affect your work? Like, I mean, what is sort of like almost dying in a situation like that, like, do to you?
Well, in the case of almost dying in a plane crash, it made me a much better flyer, which is weird, but true. And it's not because I'm not going to die in a plane crash. I'm still going to die in a plane crash. But now that I know what it's going to be like, it's okay. And, you know, my joke is that every time I get off an airplane, I view it as a failed suicide attempt. I was always a terrible flyer. I would wake my wife up on, you know, TWA or Pan Am flying out to LA and say, because she almost was a pilot. And I go, what happened? She go, what happened? And I go, well, the pitch of the plane just went from to She said, well, that happens. You know, planes change direction. Why would it change direction? We're over Kansas. What's the well, planes fly from one VOR to So anyway, I was a really bad flyer. Because my theory was, if you get hit by a bus, you're going to die kind of instantly. You're not going to have a lot of time thinking, I'm about to die. What should I have done differently? What could have happened that would have prevented me from getting on this plane? What I never should have done X or Y. Maybe I shouldn't have done Adam's Family Values and should have done Gump. All the things that can happen for the 5 minutes you're going to crash. In my case, it was 14 minutes where we were out of control, nose diving to the ground, right? But that didn't happen. I didn't relive my life. I didn't think about all the things I could have done differently. I didn't weep uncontrollably and think, what will life be like for my wife and my child without me around? Instead, I crossed my arms, I put my feet up in front of me, and I tried different line readings of, and now I die. So, and by the way, from the plane cockpit where the pilot, co-pilot, and flight attendant are behind the door, I'm hearing klaxons and warnings and beeping and recorded announcements saying, stall, stall. You know, it's bad. In fact, the story sounds so ridiculous that in my book, I published the NTSB transcript of the black box so that people could see I'm not exaggerating. And literally, when you read the transcript, literally, the co-pilot is saying things like, yee-haw, and we're not going to make it. You know, so like, this isn't like me making up a story. So first I try, and now I die. Then I try, and now I die. Then I try, and now I die. And finally, because it's only a four-word line reading, I go, and now I die. And then eventually we get over the runway and we're way too far down to land. But I think they're out of fuel, actually. We do a 180 to avoid the brick wall. And now the pilot, using her genius method of stopping the plane because the reverse thrusters aren't working, she is aiming at and crashing into parked airplanes as a way to slow us down. So we destroy five Cessnas and Piper Cubs. We leave the airport. We take out a fence. We're now in the Van Nuys parking lot. We're taking out cars. We destroy a Dodge Ram 3500 dually and come to a stop in the parking lot with the front door of the plane lodged against a pine tree, which they can't see, but I can because I'm further back in the plane. Three out of control human beings open the cockpit door. They can't get the door to the plane open because of the pine tree, which they can't see. And in a very sardonic voice, I point to all the liquid coming out of the left side engine. And I say, are we at all worried about that? And the pilot says, and you don't want a pilot to say this, she says, oh, my God. The three of them run past me, and I wait for instructions until I realize I'm alone on the airplane. They have run past me, opened the cargo door, and this was a Gulfstream 2, and they opened the cargo door and ran out and fled. Never said, hey, bear, this way, or anything. So at some point I go, I think I'm alone here. So I go to the back of the plane, past the broken china and all the little chapsticks and little individual mouthwashes they put on those private jets. And I look out the cargo door and my crew is fleeing because they think the plane's going to explode. And all the traffic helicopters all over LA are now circling the airport.
Jeez.
My pilot is ripping her epaulets off so she can't be seen as a pilot from above. And I'm standing there, and my fear of flying is second only to my fear of heights. So I'm not going to jump off the back of the plane. So eventually the fire department comes, and all the firemen get out, and they run to me, and they're screaming, get off the plane, get off the plane. But they're not specific. And at that moment, you really want specificity. So I go, it's fine for you to say, get off the plane, but who's catching me? And they go, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, wrong thing to say. Don't say it doesn't matter. Just pick one of you. It doesn't matter. Just get off the plane, get off the plane. So you look around, you find a fireman with the biggest mustache because they all have mustaches. And I said, you're catching me. And he says, I don't give a flying fuck, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah.
Because I don't give a flying fuck. Just get off the plane. So I basically hug him. I'm not that high. I'm about 7 feet off the ground. I hug him. I swing into him. And we all run away. The plane doesn't crash. But it made me a better flyer because I realized, oh, that's what it's going to be like when I die in a plane crash. I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to relive my life. If anything, I'm going to sort of like try different line readings. But here's my last piece of advice to you about, this is a life lesson, okay? It actually, in this case, involves flying, but never be an optimist. There's no upside to optimism. Here's what you want to do. Here's why pessimism is the only way to be.
Because you're never going to be disappointed.
Say what?
You'd never be disappointed, basically. Sorry.
Exactly. If you get on the plane and you elbow your best friend and you say, you know what? I think this plane is going to crash before we get to Cleveland. One of two things happens. If the plane starts to nosedive to the ground, you get to elbow your friend and say, was I right or what? And if the plane doesn't crash, you live.
Yeah.
It's win-win. There's no downside to pessimism. And that's my little gift to you today.
I love that. The only thing that would have made that story better, Barry, is if the airline was Pan Am. I just think that would have been really ironic.
No, Pan Am would be good. Yeah. No longer in existence.
Yeah, no longer. Well, listen, if you want to read, and I swear that is one story in a sea of memorable tales told by Barry Sonnenfeld, including, so the book is called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, and we didn't even touch on the amazing Hendrix story, and I don't want you to tell it here, I want people to discover it in the book. There's a reason why it's called that, and for so many other reasons. The book is called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Barry, we honestly cannot thank you enough for your time on the Real Blonde Podcast.
Yeah. Well, it was truly a pleasure. All your questions were great. And if you ever want me to do a master class about lenses, let's figure out how to do that, because I've got theories.
You don't understand. This is the podcast for that.
Yeah, this is it. You've come to the right place.
Barry, I would talk to you about lenses for 25 hours. Hearing what you were saying earlier about wide angles and panning, I've never thought of that before, and I love filmmaking, so thank you for that. I'm really into that stuff, so thank you.
All right, well, 5 months from now, let's get back together again and do this again.
Good.
We're in. Yes.
We look forward to it.
And
all right.
Barry,
thank you.
It's a date.
Thank you. Thank you for the detail about the blood symbol bar shot. I appreciated that.
All pleasure.
Thank you guys so much for listening to this bonus episode of Real Blend. Thank you to Barry Sonnenfeld for coming on and joining us for this time. If you guys want to hear more of these amazing stories written in extremely colorful language by the great Barry Sonnenfeld, the name of the book is called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Really, really funny. Some great, great Hollywood history stories. Thank you again to Barry for coming on. We will talk to you guys on the Real Blend podcast very, very soon. And because Kevin's not here, I'm the one who gets to say Dunkirk.